On this edition of the DFA podcast, we talk about the Austin Jackson signing, the Randal Grichuk trade, and we draft our favorite position players who pitch and pitchers who could play positions. There's nothing else happening, so you might as well listen. It's a DFA podcast, and it's coming your way now.
Welcome to episode 46 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, what's up on this wet, rainy, cold, no transaction Tuesday morning?
I'll just note it's none of those things here in DC. So for once in the last few weeks, I think I finally have the edge on you when it comes to weather preferences.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that somebody is having a nice sunny day. Joining us again is our producer and compatriot, comrade in arms, Sean Brody. Sean, how are things looking for you weather-wise?
It's sunny and 42 over here, so yeah, I don't know what you're talking about with your gloomy weather.
All right. Well, now that we've all talked about the weather because there's no baseball news of note to talk about, we can talk about the couple of little things that are going on in this slow drip. Drips and drabs of off-season news that we're having. So we've got a couple of minor deals to talk about, some outfielders on the move, some minor league contracts with a couple of pitchers, but really we've just got to kind of dwell on these Midwestern outfielders. I think that's the best thing I think to talk about. You guys excited for this?
I am, actually. You know, these are the kind of moves that this podcast was made for.
Yes, the ones that add a few wins on the margins. That's that's how I would describe us in most circumstances. So we'll go with our big move. And our big move for today is going to be the signing of Austin Jackson. So Austin Jackson has been picked up by the San Francisco Giants on a two-year, $6 million contract. This move was kind of proposed by a lot of Giants fans, a lot of analysts. They kind of saw this as a natural fit, that once the Giants had gone out and acquired Andrew McCutchen, or even, you know, if they'd gone out and gotten anybody to fill one of their outfield holes this offseason, they'd certainly need to add another one, and getting somebody who is more of a prototypical center fielder like Jackson seemed to be a fit. So you heard the rumors about Lorenzo Cain, and then down a little bit in terms of Cash's, somebody like Jared Dyson. And then down a little bit from there in terms of cash is Jackson. So, RJ, tell me a little bit about what you think of this Austin Jackson signing and how it's going to affect the Giants.
Well, it'd be cooler if it were Kane. Obviously, it's yes. Not because they're seemingly trying to avoid the luxury tax, which I don't think is a wise move on their part. But that's not a knock on the Jackson signing because I think he's fine. You know, over the last three seasons, although he has a reputation for being an up-and-down hitter, he's been, you know, around the league average. You know, he's not what he was when he was younger. He's not a gold glove caliber outfielder anymore. He's probably below average in center, if we're being frank. And, you know, he's not going to steal 20 bases like he did in his earlier years either. What he can do is he can provide you with a leadoff man-like approach at the plate. He's very patient, disciplined about his strike zone, and roughly league average production. He doesn't have a platoon split, so you don't necessarily have to think of him as a guy who's, you know, a right-handed sock. And, you know, if it turns out that they want to pair him with Duggar in center field, giving him a little bit more glove when they turn to Duggar, I think that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, his performance last year was way above what he had put up in 2015 and 2016 offensively, and I thought that was really interesting. You know, he's a guy who had a couple of down seasons, especially in 2016 with Chicago, but last year with the Indians, he was basically his best offensive self. A lot of that had to do with the fact that he walked even more often than he usually does. But he had a huge batting average on balls in play, kept the ball down, and posted a 387 OBP, which is, you know, if that's something we reasonably thought he could replicate next season, this would be a steal. Obviously, it's I think it's a little bit of the vagaries of BABIP. He's always been a high BABIP guy, but we've seen his performance jump up and down from season to season. I think on a little bit of that might have had to do with luck, and a little bit might have had to do with the, you know, just kind of the up and down performance from season to season. But if he was certain to replicate that performance next year, where he put up almost two wins and like 300 some odd plate appearances, we'd be like, this is the best deal the Giants have ever made. But we don't really think that's going to happen, right?
No, I don't think he's going to be quite as good as he was last season. I also don't think he's going to be as bad as he was in 2016 either, though. I mean, we talk about how he's been up and down, and that is true. Obviously, you know, earlier in his career, he looked like he'd become a budding star. Then, you know, midseason of 2014, he was dealt to Seattle and just fell off the map, and that kind of ruined that year for him. But then you look at 2015, and he had a 95 OPS plus, and I think the Giants would take that from him next season, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think just average production is much better than what the Giants had been running out there last year. I mean, their outfield was so horrible last season that I don't think there's any question that even if he can just be about a 260 true average, get on base, you know, maybe a third of the time, he's going to be a real addition to that lineup. So one of the things I wanted to talk about here is kind of the total composition of the Giants outfield now. So I mentioned that the Giants outfield last year was really bad. This year, going into this new season, now their starting outfield looks like Jackson, maybe in a platoon with Duggar, and, Duggar, like you said, but then you've got Andrew McCutchen, Hunter Pence on the corners. That's a very different outfield than they ran out there last year, in part because the only holdover, Hunter Pence, wasn't really himself last year. So do you think now their outfield is positioned to be a successful part of this Giants team going forward, or do you think they really kind of should have gone and gotten Lorenzo Cain, or they should have gone in a different direction? Do you think that having two bad center fielders in McCutchen and Jackson might make up for the fact that, you know, you'd rather have two bad center fielders than maybe a really great center fielder and a really terrible left fielder? How do you see this kind of unit as a whole?
Well, I think they should have went and gotten Cain. And again, that's not a knock on Jackson. I just think Cain is very good and would have provided them with a boost that they're not going to get from Jackson. I guess my big question for them is, what are we going to see from Hunter Pence? Because I think McCutchen is going to be a positive offensively. I don't know how he's going to take to a corner outfield position, but I assume he's going to be better there than he has been in center field, where, you know, he's consistently received below average marks. I think Jackson, like I just said, has the potential to be roughly a league average player, you know, a second division starter type. I don't know how they're going to divvy up the playing time with Duggar, but, you know, if you squint and if you're optimistic about, you know, Duggar's plus glove and maybe his bat, you can see, you know, roughly league average production on center field. I think, like we said, that's a win if you're a Giants fan at this point. With Pence, though, you know, he was really bad offensively last season, and that's not something we're accustomed to saying with Pence, because, you know, that was his 11th season in the majors, and it was the first time he had posted an OPS plus below 100, and he was all the way down to 86. He's in his mid-30s. He's obviously dealt with a number of injury issues the past few years. Is he going to rebound, or is this basically it for Pence and they're just biding their time until maybe one of these lesser outfielders, you know, whether it's Austin Slater, Jarrett Parker, whomever, steps in and replaces him? Or maybe, you know, once we get to midseason, they go out there and make a trade for whichever outfielder the Rays are throwing away at that point or what have you.
Yeah, I it's kind of hard to tell. I'm kind of mystified by this Giants team, and Jackson also gives them another guy that, you know, if they were trying to run out a team in 2012, this would be really great, you know, with him and McCutchen and Posey and Longoria and the whole slot of guys that they've got there. I do kind of see this as a team with Hunter Pence's injury issues. I kind of am with you that they need to get another outfielder perhaps. You know, whether it was going to be Cain or whether it was going to be Austin Jackson, this seems like a team that really needs a really good fourth outfielder and a pretty good fifth outfielder, especially, you know, with McCutchen on his way out, with Pence's injury issues, with Jackson maybe being a platoon guy, with Duggar maybe being a platoon guy. So, you know, if I were them, I might have wanted Jackson as my fourth outfielder, not necessarily my third outfielder. And I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. I just think that to try to jump the line and pass both the Rockies and the Diamondbacks and compete with the Dodgers, you have to make some pretty bold moves. And the Giants are doing that, but maybe, you know, especially given the scenario that's playing out with a lot of free agents being very inexpensive, maybe they need to work even harder. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I will just say, I don't think the Giants were likely to be as bad as they were last season, even if they had brought basically the entire bunch back. I don't think they were going to just win 64 games again. I think they have too many talented players. And, you know, I think Brandon Crawford's going to bounce back. I think we'll probably see – I don't know if Pence is going to bounce back because of the age stuff, but I think we'll probably see, you know, some of their pitching perform better than they did last season. So, yeah, I think this was going to be a team that was going to perform better no matter what. But I do like that they've been a little bit bold, at least bold, you know, relative to the other teams this winter by adding Longoria and McCutcheon. And, again, I think the Jackson deal is fine. It's just a matter of whether they have – whether they should have done more by bringing in Kane instead.
Yeah. And I always kind of – you talk about their pitching. I always kind of am down on Jeff Samardzija every year, pretty much constantly from the moment he came into the league. He was actually really good last year. He was pretty good in his debut season with the Giants 2 years ago. So, you know, this looks like a team that could still compete. I just really want to see them make, you know, one of those kind of game-changing moves in free agency because they've already done so well to address their holes outside of free agency. Sean, you were big into Austin Jackson a couple of years ago and have been incredibly wrong since then. You posited that he should hit more fly balls, and that wouldn't really have worked out so well for him. So what do you think about this deal?
Yeah, as usually the case, I was very wrong about Austin Jackson. I said after 2015 he should hit more fly balls, he'd be a lot better. He did hit more fly balls, he was a lot worse. So then he came to Cleveland this year, hit more ground balls, and he was really good.
Well, at least he was listening to you. I mean, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that part of the reason that's why I think that Austin Jackson's output isn't sustainable. He batted .333 on ground balls last year. That's not something, especially with his diminishing speed, that he's probably going to be able to do for a long period of time. Now, I know they only have him for a year, but that kind of raises the case to me of, you know, have Jackson in center, you know, have McCutcheon in right. You probably have Duggar in center as well, like you said, and Pence in left. That's not a very good defensive outfield for that big of a park, and I'm kind of curious why they didn't go out and get Jerrod Dyson. I know he's a lefty, but, I mean, if you're kind of debating between Jackson and Dyson, Dyson's pretty much put up at least reliable numbers at around league average, but he's also provided a ton of defensive value, whereas Jackson hasn't really ever provided much defensive value, and you can argue that his 2017 was an anomaly. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense what you're saying. The only issue I see with Dyson is the financial one. I think that the Giants either wanted to play in the shallow end of the pool or the expensive end of the pool. And, you know, if they're going to spend money, they should spend it on Kane. If they're not going to spend much money, signing Jackson's a good fit. And, you know, with Dyson, you're right that his defense is good. It's always a risk with those guys. You know, if his speed slips a little bit, he's not going to be so productive. And I was, you know, before the season, I kind of thought he was going to get something like 3-30 as far as his contract went. Now I don't see that happening. It might be something more like 3-21 or 2-18 or something like that. But, you know, Jackson's probably coming at a pretty decreased cost compared to what Dyson would bring back. So let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about another team adding another outfielder who, you know, has some questionable performance at times over the last couple of seasons. And that's the Blue Jays acquiring another outfielder. And kind of last time we talked about this, I was kind of surprised that they'd brought in Curtis Granderson as an outfielder. Now they're bringing in yet another outfielder. They've acquired Randall Grichuk from the St. Louis Cardinals, and in exchange going back to St. Louis's Dominic Leone and Connor Green. And RJ, I really want to get your feel for this one because this trade surprised me a lot. Not that the Cardinals would give up on Grichuk, but that the Blue Jays would go out and acquire him.
Yeah, and I'll just preface this by saying I don't think I'm as high on Grichuk as most everyone else because it feels like he's been around a lot longer than four seasons to me. Since we've kind of heard the same thing about him seemingly every winter, how he's poised for a breakout, how, you know, his exit velocity and his launch angle are really good. And it's true. If you look at the barrels by plate appearance statistic the StatCast provides, Grichuk is sixth in the majors last season behind Aaron Judge, J.D. Martinez, Giancarlo Stanton, Joey Gallo, and Chris Davis. That's a very good group to be with if you're a hitter. That said, I am not buying this guy. I know he's only 26. I know he can, in theory, play across the outfield. I understand all that. But let me just put it this way. He has four seasons in which he's received more than 100 plate appearances. In three of those, he's posted an on-base percentage below 290. That's, you know, that's like 30 to 40 points off the league average. His approach is, you know, usually just grip it and rip it. And he's a candidate to post the worst strikeout to walk ratio in any lineup he's a part of. I know that, again, you know, he made some adjustments to his swing late in the year to shorten his swing because it was pretty long. I don't know. I just don't think I buy that he has the upside that a lot of people do, because I don't buy that he's ever going to make enough contact or have a good enough approach to put that to good use. That said, you know, he can still be a decent contributor. I just don't buy the upside aspect that everyone is talking about. I do have thoughts on Leon as well, but I wanted to get your thoughts on Grichuk before I continue my rant here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Grichuk to me seems like a flawed but useful player. He's one of those guys who, you know, despite what you're saying about his enormous strikeout rate, his terrible approach, he provides legit power. And that is useful to a lot of teams. I feel like he is kind of best cast as a fourth outfielder, kind of a bench bat who can come in and you bring him in when there's two guys on and nobody out, and you hope for that big bomb. But I kind of agree with you that he's he's so flawed that I don't think we're going to see a breakout season. I think we want to hope for him to be something like a two-win player. And that's great, and it's useful, and I think there are a lot of teams that could benefit from that. But the Blue Jays don't seem like that team. So they've already acquired Curtis Granderson. They've already got Kevin Pillar in-house. And I know these aren't really exciting guys, but they've got Anthony Alford, they've got Dalton Pompey, and they've got Teoscar Hernandez. And if you ask me, you have to give Teoscar Hernandez – oh, and they've got Steve Pierce on the bench, and he's most often used in the outfield. And if you ask me, you've got to give Teoscar Hernandez a shot this year. I'm kind of a crazy Teoscar Hernandez booster, but I feel like he showed enough last season that he deserves some regular playing time to see if you've got somebody who's going to be useful in the long term, because with – you know, he doesn't have Grichuk power, but he's got legitimate power. And he's the type of guy who is going to be a lot cheaper than Grichuk. He probably is going to have a little bit better on base percentage than Grichuk. Give him a chance to play. So if that means you run Grichuk out there every day in left field, like, I kind of see the Granderson-Pierce as kind of a platoon-y thing that would work really well in left field. So Grichuk seems like a fourth outfielder on this team. And the Blue Jays maybe aren't the team that needs that as a fourth outfielder, especially when you've got Pompey and Alford waiting in the wings. He seems like this seems like the type of move that a team like the Cubs or a team that's really looking to kind of break into the next level. The Giants would be a terrific fit for Grichuk before they started doing this as kind of that Hunter Pence, in case of emergency, break glass kind of guy behind Pence. So I really was kind of confused by this from that perspective. That having been said, I'm not sure the Cardinals gave up a whole lot. I mean, the Blue Jays gave up a lot to the Cardinals to get him. But we can talk a little bit about Leon, like you said, because I wasn't thrilled with the return by this, but I guess you shouldn't be because Grichuk's not all that exceptional.
Right, and I agree with everything you said about Grichuk there. Again, it's just a matter of the upside aspect that people – ascribed to him that I just don't buy into at this point. With regards to Leon, I'm going to be honest with you. I did not realize how good he had been last season. I know, you know, he's been around for a few years as well, and when he first broke into the majors with Seattle, there was a lot of talk that he could eventually become a late-inning reliever for them. Then he kind of bounced around a little bit, and then he resurfaced last year with Toronto, 70 innings, 2.56 ERA, 2.94 FIP. That's powered by more than 10 strikeouts per nine. Those are pretty good numbers. And, you know, having watched him, we're talking a mid-90s fastball, an upper 80s to low 90s cutter, and then a slider on top of that. So it's a pretty interesting profile because he's able to pitch above the hands with his fastball. And, you know, he's still able to get that slider slash cutter. I guess they're separate pitches, but get both of them down and away to righties. So you know, it's an interesting profile. I don't know that he's going to repeat last season, and I don't know if that should be the expectation here because, you know, it's kind of hard to repeat that in general. So I guess this is a case where the Cardinals figured we have a lot of outfield depth ourselves. We really have not addressed our bullpen much beyond, you know, the one signing of Luke Gregerson. Let's get Leon. Let's see if he can perhaps slot in as our seventh inning guy. I don't know if it's necessarily a good deal in terms of the value we'd like to see because, you know, Leon has had issues with left-handed batters. He's probably more of a middle reliever than a setup guy, big pitcher. Mm-hmm. But even if you can get away from the idea that maybe they lost this deal in a vacuum, and, you know, we haven't mentioned Connor Green at all, but he seems like a lottery ticket. I know Christopher Crawford of Roto World said, you know, the best-case scenario is Fernando Rodney. Well, I don't think that's likely because, you know, Fernando Rodney is pretty much a special bird in his own right, I think. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think this is necessarily the kind of deal you expected for the Cardinals in a vacuum because of the fact they basically traded for a reliever who's had one good year in his last three tries. But it makes sense within the context of a team. And I actually think it makes more sense within the context of a team for the Cardinals than it does the Blue Jays for the reasons you mentioned. And, yeah, I'm a Teoscar Hernandez fan too, so I was a little surprised that they kind of blocked him out of a gig.
Yeah, that is surprising. So going back to Leon real quickly, you know, last year, like you said, he was extremely effective. Part of his problem since he was good in 2014 and he was good in 2017 was injury issues, and it led to some diminished velocity. His velocity came back a little bit last year, and it seemed to be coming back a little bit more near season's end, which is probably a good sign. But the one thing that I do concern myself with a little bit is he was also leaning a lot more heavily on his cutter last year. Yeah. And that's a good pitch. But I always get nervous when guys are using their cutter more and more because sometimes that's something that's associated with injury. He's already been injured. His velocity still isn't quite back to where it is before. But I agree with you completely. If you look at it from the Cardinals' perspective, they certainly need a sixth or seventh inning guy. And Leon, if he can do, I don't know, half again as much as he did last year, makes a really great sixth or seventh inning guy, probably a guy they would move to more the end of the bullpen given the way they're kind of composed. So kudos to them. I think this was a fine deal for both sides. I think it was a part that they didn't really need. I just look at this and I think the Blue Jays have got to be thinking the same thing that you were saying before, where they are seeing a breakout where perhaps we don't see one for Grichuk. And the Cardinals kind of saw it as we've got a part that's a somewhat useful outfielder, but not great, and we can trade it to get back a somewhat useful but not great reliever, and we need that more for our roster composition than we do need another outfielder.
Yeah, and I would say with regards to the cutter usage, you can also see that affect the fastball in other ways because mm-hmm. if you think about it, you know, if you keep getting onto the side of the baseball to throw your cutter, and in Leon's case, his slider, that can affect whether you're getting on top of the fastball. And, you know, that can cause your fastball to flatten out and whatnot. And, you know, with the Cardinals, let's not forget, they have Jose Martinez. Depending on what they do at first base, they could potentially have Jose Martinez, Harrison Bader, and Tyler O'Neill just a call away. So they have plenty of right-handed outfield depth to make this deal. Yeah. And also, Grichuk, I believe, had just kind of, I don't want to say complained about potentially being in a utility, or excuse me, in a bench role, but I think he had voiced displeasure with the idea of not starting. So maybe this is also about, you know, doing a favor to a guy who'd been in your system for a few years and taking advantage of your depth to fill a weakness. So we'll see how it works out. But it's an interesting trade. And now that we've both agreed that Grichuk is not going to break out and that Leon is not going to break out, they're both going to continue. Or excuse me, in Leon's case, he's going to continue to pitch well. And Grichuk is going to have like a 5-win year. Who knows? Maybe he'll outperform Mike Trout and people say, see, that's why they chose him before Mike Trout.
Oh, my God. If I never have to hear that again, I'll be so happy. All right. So that'll cover the two biggest moves of the past, I guess, maybe 5 or 6 days. Sean, can you hit us with a couple of smaller moves in our batting practice segment?
Yeah. So the Padres picked up Alan Craig. He was released earlier this year from the Red Sox. He never really came back after 2015. He had a long bout with injuries. 2017, he performed better in the minor leagues. Ended up slugging .316, though, so the power never really came back. But, I mean, Alan Craig's name, that's kind of what our show is about, right? The older guys that we kind of Still remember?
Yeah, this is a wild thing. I still cannot believe that he went from being such a good hitter in 2012 and 2013 to absolutely nothing, and then, you know, basically immediately after that 2013 season, and now the kind of purgatory that is the San Diego Padres system. If there's any team where he has a chance of making the major leagues this year, I think this might be it, even though the team is, you know, relatively well-stocked with Will Myers. You know, a Will Myers injury basically means that it's going to be either like him or Josh Naylor, who's the next man up as the first baseman. So I guess it's a good situation for him to be in. It's just I still cannot fathom how he got so bad offensively so fast. And you mentioned that his performance ticked up last year. He only played 47 games in Pawtucket last year. And yes, he hit better, but he was still below league average for AAA. So this is not something we should be projecting he's going to be back.
Yeah, I doubt he would be called up. I mean, you know, he's only played like 70 games last two seasons, excuse me, closer to 80 games last two seasons total. And like you said, he hasn't hit. He's not even hitting in the minor leagues anymore. And he's 33 years old. Generally, if you're not hitting in the minors at that point, you know, you're not going to ever return to the majors. Maybe he gets healthy and figures something out. And it would be a nice story. So I kind of hope that does happen, but it doesn't seem likely.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So our next one up, we have the Diamondbacks signing Fernando Salas, Chris Medlin, Antonio Bastardo, and Blazek. So, which one do you want to start with, Brian? Because I'm guessing it's Fernando Salas.
Yeah, probably at this point. I mean, Salas was badly overworked by the Mets, and his performance dipped off. And then after recovering a little bit in Los Angeles, he seemed like he might be somewhat back to his old self. But he's definitely damaged goods. He's just one of those guys that I think that if everything breaks right, he could come up and be like worth half a win or something like that, and be kind of a useful part in that Diamondbacks bullpen. But yeah, none of these guys really jump out at me as being, wow, we got ourselves a steal on the NRI list. I don't know if any of them really is going to move the needle much for the Diamondbacks.
To be fair, though, if a guy looked like such a steal on an NRI deal, he probably wouldn't be getting an NRI deal. So, you know, it's kind of a double-edged
sword logic.
Yeah, and, you know, I used to be a huge Chris Medlin fan. He was, you know, athletic, and he knew how to pitch, and he had multiple pitches. And, you know, I kind of overlooked the short thing because, you know, you have to sometimes with these guys. But, yeah, I don't know. This is an interesting offseason for the Diamondbacks bullpen because, as we all know, you know, they kind of needed to restructure a little bit. And you look at what they've done this winter. In addition to these NRIs, they went out there and traded for Brad Boxberger. They signed Hirono. I think it's Hirono, right?
Hirono, yeah.
Yeah, Hirono, sorry, the Japanese free agent. And they also took Albert Suarez in the World 5 draft, which is a little unusual because, you know, Suarez actually has some big league – I don't want to say success necessarily, but some big league experience with the Giants. And I guess – you could probably call his 2016 a success, but I thought that was interesting because, you know, you don't usually see guys like that taken in the Rule 5 draft, in part because he's like 28 years old, but also in part because he had some major league time. So they go out here now with a couple of these. I mean, basically all these deals were designed to potentially give them some depth in the bullpen. I think it's an interesting approach. I don't know if any of these guys will work out. If I had to guess, it'll be probably Salas because I – seemingly liked him more than most people over the years, but I don't know. I guess you buy by the bundle and hope that one of them turns into a decent middle relief option for you.
Yeah, and I do want to touch real briefly on Chris Medlin. He didn't pitch in the majors last year, but he got a bunch of starts in the minors for the Braves. I'm kind of shocked that he hasn't been moved to the bullpen yet. Because ever since he's come back from his injury, he seems to be primarily a starter, if not only a starter, when in his time back with the Royals and with the Braves. I wonder if the move to the bullpen, especially given last year that his strikeout rate started to tick up, the injury issues, maybe it would be a good time to move him to the bullpen. And the Diamondbacks have had some success with those bullpen conversions in the past, whether it's Archie Bradley or even Randall Delgado to some extent. So maybe there's a chance there that actually moving him to the pen instead of trying to keep him as a starting pitcher where he's got more value if he ever did come back. But I don't see him coming back as a starter at this point.
I agree with you, and I wonder if it's a thing where he just wants to start, and maybe that's why he hasn't moved to the bullpen. Because if you remember, when he first came up, I mean, he was primarily a reliever. It wasn't until, you know, 2013, a couple years into his big league career, that he became a full-time starter. And while he certainly had the arsenal to start, again, you know, I just mentioned he had multiple pitches, he was athletic, threw strikes, blah, 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 you know, there's no reason he couldn't make a fine reliever, assuming, you know, the stuff is still there. And obviously I did not see him last year, so I don't know what the stuff looks like. But yeah, I would be interested in seeing him in a bullpen role. And even if he's just giving you some length out of the bullpen, you know, that can have value, you know, especially nowadays with how teams are running their staffs and, you know, how no one is necessarily guaranteed to get that third time through the order unless you're someone like, you know, Zach Greinke. So yeah, that would be interesting. And, hopefully he gets a shot, and hopefully he makes the most of it.
So since we're still on the Diamondbacks, I do have one more question. Looking at kind of their what they also have that hasn't come up yet, we have Shelby Miller who comes back in May, probably June-ish at the latest. Where does Shelby Miller fit in with this pitching staff?
I mean, to me, the short answer is that he doesn't. The 2018 Shelby Miller comeback to me should be found money for the Diamondbacks. And you don't rush him. You let him get his feet under him. Maybe you give him a lot of rehab starts in AAA, and you roll with the five guys they've got in terms of Greinke, Ray, Walker, Corbin, and Zach Godley. And if Miller comes back and his velocity's back and his command is back very quickly from the Tommy John surgery, great. It's a benefit. But if not, I just really take it slow with Miller and, you know, hope to get him back to 100% for 2019.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, honestly, these things tend to work themselves out. And by the time Miller's ready to return, you know, someone else in the rotation will probably require 2 or 3 weeks off. And, you know, frankly, we're at the point where teams are strategically putting guys on the disabled list. And, you know, by the time Miller is ready to return, it's possible that the Diamondbacks are comfortable where they are in the playoff race, and maybe they want to give Corbin or Walker or Ray or even Greinke, you know, 2 or 3 times off through the rotation, and they just, you know, create an injury for them to go on the DL, and, you know, they kind of leverage that depth until you get to September, where then rosters are fattened, and maybe you run a 6-man rotation or, you know, something funky to get to the postseason. You know, from there, who knows? Maybe you slot in Miller in the bullpen, and maybe he becomes this year's Archie Bradley for them, a guy who can go out there and throw multiple innings. I don't really know, you know, how that's going to play out, but I don't think it's a bad thing to have more starting pitchers than slots, because if you remember, they went through some injury woes last year, and they kind of had to reach into non-existent depth. I mean, Braden Shipley has not lived up to his draft stock, and I know they have Anthony Banda, but you know, it's always nice to have one or two more starting pitchers than need be, because the Diamondbacks know as well as anyone that you can kind of burn through those guys if you're not careful.
Yeah, I'm with you. I would really like to see them convert Shipley to relief. Again, I'm really into making sure that you get the most out of your starting pitchers and get that value, because they're so rare to have even an average starting pitcher versus a reliever. But I would love to see Shipley as kind of a 2-inning reliever and see if his stuff can come up a little bit in that role, because being able to go to an effective Shipley and an effective Archie Bradley in that bullpen will shorten games a ton for folks, and I just don't know if Shipley's going to be able to do anything as a starter at this point.
That makes sense.
So our next one is the Chicago Cubs signing Chris Jimenez, who was Yu Darvish's catcher this offseason. Foreshadowing much?
I think it's the Cubs trying to foreshadow a Darvish move. I don't know if this is a move that actually does bring – I don't think this is what would we call it? I don't think this is an indicator that a Darvish move is imminent. I think that this is an indicator that the Cubs would love to bring back Yu Darvish. What do you think, RJ?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I'll just say that even if they do not get Yu Darvish because of his deal or because of whatever reason, I think Jimenez is a smart addition to this club. You know, I was familiar with him from his days in Tampa Bay, and he's an intelligent guy. He's seemingly good at handling a staff, and his offense has always been up and down, but defensively he seems fine, and, you know, to slot him in as your backup catcher makes a lot of sense when you have a option like Wilson Contreras, who's going to play most days. And I know that he's not necessarily a sexy choice. You know, he's 35. He's got like a career 78 OPS plus. If you're a Cubs fan, you might have preferred them rolling with Victor Caratino instead. But I think Jimenez makes a lot of sense, and he's sort of the kind of guy who it doesn't surprise me that it wouldn't surprise me if Joe Madden really wanted him again, because Jimenez almost has those Josh Paul qualities to him. And if you remember earlier in Madden's time with Tampa Bay, he had Josh Paul kind of hang around and help Deonner Navarro develop and whatnot and work with the younger pitchers. And I think you can see that effect here of Jimenez. So it wouldn't surprise me if he's their backup catcher. And frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if he's basically auditioning for a post-playing career with the Cubs organization, either in a development role or in some kind of front office role.
Yeah, I think that's all good points. The other things that I'll bring up here are that, one, I think the Cubs like to run three catchers, in part because they can give Contreras spots in the outfield, and Jimenez seems like kind of the perfect third catcher for this team. Part of the reason why is he threw five innings in six games last year. He is also your garbage time pitcher, in addition to being a suitable third catcher. He's got all those intangibles like you were talking about. If he does want to move into a coaching or a player development role at the end of his career, Chicago's probably just about one of the best places that he could do that. You know, John Baker's still there. They've got the Madden experience, all of that. They've done a nice job of trying to transition players into post-playing roles on that team. I really like it. I think it's a great move, and I just wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the guys who are complaining, well, he's going to block Victor Caratini, I think you're going to see that he doesn't. I think he's going to be one of those guys to play every once in a while and provide those intangibles mostly.
Yeah, and let's just throw this out there. I'll throw it out there to both of y'all. Do you think that Jimenez is going to make more than – let's say one relief appearance next season? Like, do you see Madden getting really creative and funky and actually using Jimenez basically as a garbage time pitcher? Do you think he'll use him maybe once every other week if a situation dictates it? Or do you think this is sort of, or that aspect, I should say, is sort of overhyped when it comes to Jimenez?
Well, I mean, I would definitely say it's overhyped. I don't see him getting five full innings like he did last year, but I definitely see the team using him more than just once. Like, if you were going to put the over under at 1.5 appearances for Jimenez next year, I would go the over. I just wouldn't expect him to throw more than like three or four garbage innings when, you know, if the mood strikes or if they're down a pitcher or if they want to get really aggressive with using the bullpen on, you know, back-to-back days against tough teams and they get blown out. So I don't think it's anything to make of it. He's not a good pitcher. We're not talking about Shohei Ohtani. We're not talking about Drew Butera even in terms of his ability to strike some guys out if I was going to have position players pitching power rankings, Jimenez is one of the more used guys, but he's also one of the worst. So, you know, it doesn't really matter that much.
What about you, Brody? Let's say 1.5 appearances. Are you going over or under?
I mean, you have to go the under just because it's the Cubs, because you have to wonder how many appearances he'll actually get. But, yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Brian that, I don't see it happening.
He pitched three innings with the Indians in 2016, and he pitched five innings with the Twins last year. So his trend line is rising.
Yeah, I'm going to go over because, remember, Joe Madden is the same manager who once trotted out Sam Fold on the mound in a game that I believe the Rays led by like a run or two in order to give his actual reliever more time to warm up. I could totally see Madden getting cute with this and using Jimenez, even in games they were up, you know, if they're up by, you know, five plus runs, I could totally see him trying to sneak Jimenez in there and give whomever, you know, an extra day off or whatever. But then again, you know, they also have Eddie Butler, and I feel like Eddie Butler is the ultimate garbage time pitcher. Yeah. So maybe they won't need him, but yeah, I'm going to go over anyway. And even if it's only three or four appearances, I'm sure Madden will do something very weird with it. Maybe like, I don't know, could we see a double switch or some kind of defensive sub where Madden places Jimenez a catcher for one batter and then brings him to the mound and then maybe switches him back? Because that would be very cute and very Madden-like, I feel like.
And it would be so annoying because the catcher's gear, I think it's perfect for Joe Maddon. Like, can you just, I can totally see them like slowing down a game for like 15 minutes because, you know, he and Wilson Contreras have to get into and out of their catcher's gear. That would be terrible. I definitely see that happening.
Yeah. It's going to be a September game against the Cardinals. It's going to be like a four and a half hour affair. They're in the 12th inning. It's a, you know, the Cubs took the lead in the top half of the inning, and Maddon's going to do all these mechanisms to like get two or three different pitchers in the game. And man, I can't, I just hope I'm not working that night because I don't want to write about it, but I want to observe it. And I want to be like, yeah, that's Joe Maddon. That's his thing.
Yep. And we'll read all the headlines the next day. Cubs beat Cardinals 12-11 in the 17th inning. The box score is going to be like Jimenez CPLFCPC or something bizarre like that. It'll be awful. Okay, so I do want to take this a slightly different direction just real quickly. Sean, will you give me your top non-Otani position player pitching for 2018? Is it Jimenez or is it somebody else?
Ooh, my top non-position player pitching. My mind's going blank when I'm trying to think of the guy from San Diego actually getting another shot.
Christian Bethencourt?
Yes, Bethencourt. I mean, obviously, that's the go-to, honestly.
And so Bethencourt did get a minor league deal. We haven't talked about it because it's Christian Bethencourt, and he did not do very well last year. But he is in the Brewers system now, and so he'll be heading to spring training with Milwaukee. So there's a chance. There's always a chance.
I would say Mitch Moreland because I believe he actually pitched.
Mitch Moreland.
Let's go. Can we flip this? Because who would be your top pitcher who, let's say he doesn't even have to have actual hitting experience, but who would be the pitcher who you would like to see try two-way? Because I'm going with Marco Gonzalez. I believe he actually did hit at Gonzaga. He seems like a very good athlete. And, you know, the Mariners are interested in a Tony. Maybe they could try Gonzalez at first base now and again or a DH or whatever and, you know, have some fun with it.
Oh man, that's a really good one. Sean, do you have a pitcher you want to see play a position this year?
Nah, I'm gonna defer to y'all on this one.
So the position, I want to answer my own question from before. I definitely think that JD Davis from the Astros is your big time position player pitching last year. You looked sharp last year taking the mound.
That is a great call.
For the Astros, and he's especially my dude, and he'll also not get a regular job with the Astros unless he can throw. He can prove he can pitch, so that's a thing. But as far as a pitcher taking the field, my guy is always Tony Sipp. For whatever reason, it seems like, you know, because he's a lefty specialist, he gets thrown into those Waxahachie swaps where the pitcher goes and plays the outfield. Relatively frequently for a guy that, like, he always is the first guy I think of when I think of the Waxahachie swap. So he's my guy to get a couple of appearances in the outfield. Now, the only problem is I don't think he has a job. it's a lot easier to play when you're playing. So I'm a little concerned that he may not actually be in the league anymore.
What a Casey Stengel-like observation there. It's a lot easier to play when you're actually playing. And I just want to note before we move on here that Marco Gonzalez has 15 career plate appearances. He's hit 333, 333, 500. So I feel validated in a very, very small way.
I mean, way to go with that. That's really good. He's actually – yours was actually a well-thought-out, smart, excellent answer as opposed to mine, which is just like, hey, doesn't that guy play left field sometimes? So well done there. Well done there. I guess the other guy that I'll throw out there is probably Syndergaard. I think he would make an excellent offensive player. He's a pretty good hitter as a pitcher, but I think he's so intimidating that, like, you could put him at first base and he'd provide a big target for guys to throw to in the field. And, you know, he can do just about anything, so that would be the other guy I'd come up with.
I feel like Zach Greinke is probably the best pitcher who we would potentially see that because wasn't there this anecdote a few years back where Alex Gordon was struggling still, and Greinke took Gordon into the video room and showed him a home run that Greinke could hit and was like, you should do that more often.
I feel like, I do remember that story.
I feel like Greinke would just take it so seriously. And, you know, for his career, he's actually got a 571 OPS. So, you know, I mean, maybe, probably not. Probably not, actually, but maybe.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It's got to be either Greinke or Bumgarner if we're going to be serious.
Oh, yeah. Of course, it's Bumgarner.
But at the same time, like, Greinke is just enough of a dude that it would just – he would work hard at it. He would get really good at it, and he'd be absolutely insufferable, and that would be fantastic. I'd really appreciate that. Anyone who pulls that on Alex Gordon is both a hero and a complete jerk. So,
Brian, if you had to guess Noah Syndergaard's slugging percentage for his career, what is it?
I would go with, like, 280.
RJ, you want to take a shot?
It has to be higher than 280 because you would not have asked if it was like 280. So I'm going to go 340.
345 in 130 plate appearances.
Wow. Well done. Well done.
Impressive. I am so glad I picked that number out of nowhere. I was just like, I'm going to go like 50 points higher, and I added 10 because I'm a weirdo. So yeah, that's validation.
Here's another question. Who has struck out less over the course of their career, Jacob DeGrom or Noah Syndergaard?
You wouldn't have asked this if it wasn't DeGrom.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling my hand. DeGrom, 25.6% K rate in 246 plate appearances. Noah Syndergaard, a 50% K rate. He struck out 65 times.
Syndergaard's just Dave Kingman. Let's just, you know, the pitching version of Dave Kingman, I assume, if he were actually to get consistent at bats.
I mean, let's throw a couple of things out here. His career on base percentage, Syndergaard's, is 273. So he's basically Randall Grichuk.
Oh my gosh! Well, you're gonna get okay. So here's the thing: you're gonna get in trouble. Like, he's gonna listen to this somehow, and that's gonna be the note. Even though I was like, I don't buy in this dude at all. That's gonna be what really sets him off and gets us an ugly email. So.
Oh yeah, for sure. Whew. But His career slash line is 200, 273, 345. And if you bump up that slugging percentage, you know, just 50 points or so, you pretty much got Randall Grichuk right there.
That is accurate.
You get a nasty letter to the editor.
I was going to say, that's fine. If Randall Grichuk is actually listening to this, I accept my wholehearted apologies, but I'm 100% sure he's not.
Yeah. So I think we have one other move, right, Sean?
Yep, we got one more, and that's Chasen Bradford being claimed from the Mets going to the Mariners. So, Brian, what's your favorite way to spell Chasen Bradford's name?
My favorite way to spell it is not to spell it. It is a bad first name. It is terrible, and it is bad. It's pronounced Chase, I believe, which is even worse.
That's annoying. Let me just say, though, I think this is a good little get for the Mariners because this is the exact type of reliever who I think about when I think about Jerry Dipoto bullpen moves. You know, he's a big believer that you need multiple looks and that all the different arm angles and all the different deliveries and stuff profiles can help. And I don't know if that's true or not because I don't think I've ever seen someone study it. But when you watch Bradford, he looks like a Rugi. He has that crossfire delivery where he steps across his body. He has that lower arm slot. Just looking at his career splits in the majors, and it's a small sample size, of course, but he's held righties to a sub-600 OPS. He has a strikeout-to-walk ratio of nearly 4, and against lefties, and he somehow faced more lefties than righties last season, those numbers are a 715 OPS and 1 strikeout per walk. So I think he could easily pop up as a guy who surprises with the Mariners in a Rugie role. Now, whether teams are still willing to carry Rugies in 2018 is anyone's guess, and whether teams are willing to even employ baseball players in 2018 is a debate to be had. But, you know, DePoto has done his thing this winter. He signed Juan Nicasio to a, you know, fairly solid deal. He also went out there and traded for Sean Armstrong, and I believe he claimed Mike Morin off waivers. So this is what DePoto does. He tries to build cheap bullpens, and he likes guys who are different for various reasons. I mean, they also got Nick Rumbelow, who I thought that was a savvy little get as well. So we'll see how it works out, but, you know, DePoto be DePotoing.
I have nothing of value to add to what you just said about Bradford and the Mariners. It was well thought out. It was smart. I agree with it all. I want to talk about the fact that there are two Chasins right now in Major League Baseball, Chasen Bradford of the Mariners, Chasen Shreve. Do you know that both of these Chasins were born in Las Vegas?
What are the odds of that?
Well, there's got to be a thing about the name, and it's a Vegas thing. Because otherwise it makes no sense to me. I had never heard the name Chasen as a first name before this. And this is just – it's blowing my mind right now. They were born in about a year apart, Bradford and Shreve, and they were both born in Las Vegas. So
they have the same middle name. No, they don't. One's David and one's Dean. But if they did – well, were they born on the same day? Let's see here, July 12th, 1990 for Shreve and for Bradford, August 15th, 1989. So no, not quite the same name, but that would have been amazing.
It's one of those things. So please, you know, we've never received an email from anybody in terms of this show before, but if somebody knows what's going on with people's first names in Las Vegas and unnecessary N's being added to the end of Chase, please let us know. We've got a hotline. We'll set it up for you. You've got to let us know what's going on out there because, quite frankly, it's upsetting for me.
That's a good place to end it before Brian. You know, you've already upset the Grichuk family, so let's not poke the bear that is the Las Vegas parenting community.
If you do want to send us an email, our email address for the show is dfapodcast@baseballprospectus.com. Baseball Prospectus is where you can find all of my writing and absolutely none of Sean's or RJ's current writing, although there's a great amount of back RJ Anderson articles that you can go read at Baseball Prospectus. But if you want the up-to-the-minute best RJ Anderson content today, you'll have to go to CBS Sports, where RJ, tell us a little something about some of the last couple of pieces you've written over there.
Okay. The last one that came out that I would say is perhaps worth your time for reasons that have to do with, you know, the reporting that went into it, dealt with how marketing departments across the league are handling the slow off season, and the answer might surprise you. I've also done some recent pieces on the EE Gaming's Twitter bot account and the Gummy Arts Twitter art account, Twitter account. And if you're familiar with either of those, they're fun little things that might enhance your experience as a baseball fan if you're into Twitter and whatnot. And, you know, I have some other hopefully interesting pieces in the, let's just say they're marinating. So hopefully in the next few weeks we'll have a few more interesting things going on. But yeah, and plus, you know, it's Hall of Fame season, so there's been a lot of Hall of Fame coverage, and I suppose that's probably the worst possible pitch to make for, you know, if I want someone to come click on our stuff is, hey, we've been writing about the Hall of Fame. But yeah, so if you're going to go read Dane Perry's work and Exceza and Snyder. They are very good as well. They're better, you know, they're the ones who carry the bunch, and I just am happy to tag along. So yes, that's my very, very professional and well-worked sales pitch to visit CBSSports.com/MLB.
I don't know how I could have said it better, except for the fact that RJ, of course, is selling himself short. Some of the best content that's out there on the site is what's written by RJ. And so everybody check that out. Check out our Twitter account. It's at DFA Podcast. You can get up to the minute. Actually, I don't know if we've got any content on the Twitter account at this point, but it certainly exists. You can certainly interact with us through it. Check out the podcast on Blog Talk Radio and at baseballprospectus.com. But on behalf of this team, I'd like to say thanks for listening, and we will get back in touch with you, provided that any team ever signs another free agent again. Thanks for listening.